He said, I went to Samarra, went to a prison where I was going to stay, and I asked him that, can you take me to the house of Ibn al-Raza? Ibn al-Raza is the title of the 9th and 10th and 11th Imam. Because Imam Raza alayhi salam was very famous during his days, his son, grandson, and great-grandson also were all known by the title of Ibn al-Raza. And the host said to him that, don't you know that the Mutawakkil has forbidden Ibn al-Raza to come out of his house? He was kind of in a house arrest, and nobody is allowed to go and see him. So this Christian, Yusuf bin Ya'qub, says, you know, I was thinking, what do I do? I would like to pay this money before I go and see Mutawakkil. He says, then an idea came to my mind. If your intentions are clear, Allah gives you the way. He says, I thought about it for a while, and then an idea came to me that I'll go out. Allah will take me to where I want to go. And he says, you know, the donkey went from one alley to another until he reached to a door and he stopped. And we tried to, you know, make him move forward, and he wouldn't move forward. So then he says, I asked my slave to go and ask around, whose house is this? And the response came, Hadhihi daru Ibn al-Ridha. This is the house of Ibn al-Raza. So he said, if, you know, this is the most sufficient proof from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about this. And then they knocked on the door, a servant came in, and as soon as the servant saw me, he says, he asked him, Anta Yusuf bin Ya'qub? Without even, you know, him saying anything. And he says, to me, this was the second indication that I'm in the right place. That I didn't even give my name, and they already know about me. So he, you know, called me in to sit in the front area of the house. And then he says, the servant came in again, and he says, you have 100 dinars with you? Give me that envelope. And he says, well, hadhihi thalitha, this is the third indication. I had not yet even talked to them about why I'm here. And then he came again, the servant, and he said, come inside, you have been called. And so he says, he went to the imam, I talked to him, he says, I told him, you know, I don't need to really discuss anything more. The signs that I have seen are sufficient. But imam asked him, but are you not yet ready? And he hesitated. And then imam, by himself, he said, I know you will die as a Christian. You will not become a Muslim. But you have a son by this name. He will become a Muslim, not only a Muslim, he will become from the Shias of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wa salam.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Lebanese National Army has organized a tour for the diplomatic representatives and members of the United Nations Security Council to show them the places of disputes between Lebanon and Israel and Tel Aviv's violations all along Lebanon's southern borders. The first stop was in the Naqoura area B1, where the first Israeli violation in the sea was spotted at the venue in 1967. The coordinator of the Lebanese government at the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, Brigadier General Munir Shahadeh, told reporters that the army has recorded thousands of Israeli violations in the sea, land, and air, in addition to permanent violations. Meanwhile, Lebanese army spokesman provided foreign delegations a briefing on the disputed area.
But before the brief, please have a look on the illustrative sketch of the current situation at Naqoura Bayhead. Here have the tunnel entrance on Lebanese side. The blue line is withdrawal line, blue line. And the green line is the international borders green line. And the red line is permanent violation of Israel enemy forces, technical fence on Lebanese territories. And the red triangle here is the violation area.
After a briefing from the Lebanese army, some of the diplomatic representatives gave their observations.
We heard from our friends in the Lebanese army about their argument concerning more than one area on the border. We believe it is very important to find a solution to these disputes. We in Russia always support the Lebanese government, and we support any diplomatic and peaceful efforts to resolve these violations.
When asked about the obvious Israeli violations, the UK's military attaché did not have a clear answer.
There's clearly progress that needs to be made in terms of agreeing where the demarcation lines are, both in terms of the land and on the sea. So we know that there is more work that needs to be done between the two countries to make that clearer.
The tour comes days before the United Nations Security Council renews the annual mandate of the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, which was originally established to confirm the withdrawal of Israeli forces after its first invasion in 1978. The Lebanese army has refused any attempted mediation by the U.S. to work on a new land demarcation, stressing that they do not recognize the blue line as an official border line, since Lebanon's official border with occupied Palestine are internationally recognized. The Lebanese army has confirmed through its tour today that the blue line drawn in 2000 is a withdrawal line and not an official border. The Israelis have not only violated the international border demarcated in 1923 between Lebanon and Palestine, but have violated the blue line on a daily basis since the end of the 2006 war. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Rain or shine, they've been here for more than 3 months. Palestine supporters from the local community and from afar camped out outside a weapons factory owned by Israel's largest arms company, Elbit Systems, in Leicester, England. Their aim, to shut it down for good. Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's drones factory that activists say accounts for the majority of the Israeli regime's UAV fleet, which the company denies. Outside, reminders of how Israel uses them.
Israeli arms factories that are in Britain, and this particular one makes drones and other types of munitions and components. Elbit collectively make just about every single piece of weaponry that you can think of. It's really imperative we shut this particular factory down. It has 6 armed export licenses worth £5 million a year that go to Israel that are then used to terrorize and bomb the Palestinian people.
It all started 100 days ago when Palestine Action members laid siege to the site. But they were arrested and removed by police in May for, quote, conspiracy to do criminal damage.
Palestine Action have laid siege to the company across the country for the past 2 years, leading to the permanent closure of 2 sites and costing the company more than $400 million in lost contracts with the British Ministry of Defense. The void, after they were forcibly removed from here, has been filled in by other pro-Palestinian activists, among them Leicester locals, who say this site here is next.
The 2 closed sites included Elbit's London headquarters and a factory in Greater Manchester, the result of Palestine Action's sustained campaign of direct action in the past 2 years. But it hasn't been easy for them.
Back in May, we were arrested most of the Palestine Action people were arrested, and we were given bail conditions. They took our phones and they gave us bail conditions not to be by the site. So what it's meant is that all the people who were really committed routinely were not able to support holding the site.
Yet none of that has fazed these activists, who say every moment an Elbit site is forced to close is a triumph for the Palestinian cause. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Western countries turn their backs on the people of Afghanistan as the NGOs and charities are facing a severe funding gap. Jan Egeland, the head of NRC, in a recent statement has said the NATO countries are turning a blind eye to the plight of the starving Afghan children they left behind, only because the country is not strategically as important as it once used to be. According to some Afghan analysts, Western nations bear responsibility for the challenges endured by the Afghan population and should take corrective measures to address their mistakes.
The plights which Afghan people are facing today are caused mostly by NATO countries, especially the U.S., which invaded our country for 20 years. Today's devastation and crisis in our country are all the results of the U.S. ill policies and decisions. First, they fought a war here, then handed the country to the Taliban, and now they are putting our people under pressure with economic restrictions.
The UN says more than 28 million people in Afghanistan are in dire need of humanitarian aid, especially women and children. Many of them are on the brink of famine and malnutrition. Afghan people say they are awaiting foreign aid for their survival, as they have lost their incomes.
We are not receiving foreign aid anymore. I'm an ordinary worker. I come here every morning to get a job, but no one hires us and we go back home with nothing in our hands. I have a large family and we live in a rented house. I call on the global community not to forget our plights and help us with anything they can. This is the situation of everyone here.
Our sole complaint is that the Western countries created this situation and left us behind. They fueled the war, instability and poverty here and escaped at once. They claim to be sending relief aid, but their small donations are not enough, nor are they reaching qualified people.
This comes as the UK government has been criticized for slashing its aid to Afghanistan by more than half. The US has also frozen Afghan central bank assets and maintained sanctions, paralyzing the economy and other vital infrastructure. After 2 decades of the NATO invasion of Afghanistan, people here are struggling to meet their basic needs. They are calling for more humanitarian aid from wealthy countries and international organizations to mitigate the crisis in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The chairman of the National Assembly of Vietnam, Vuong Dinh Hu, arrived in Tehran heading a high-level parliamentary delegation at an invitation of his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf. In a meeting, the visiting Vietnamese parliament speaker expressed hope that during this trip, the two countries would be able to expand and develop economic and commercial cooperation, as the countries enjoy a lot of capacity for economic cooperation and investment. Iran's parliament speaker, for his part, said Iran's priority in foreign policy is to pay special attention to East Asian states, including Vietnam, due to existing cultural commonalities. Right after the meeting, Iran and Vietnam signed a memorandum of understanding to expand parliamentary cooperation.
Parliamentary diplomacy between the two countries can prepare the ground for strengthening bilateral ties at both regional and international levels. Further efforts should be made to strengthen cultural, tourism, scientific and academic cooperation between the two countries and promote the exchange of citizens' visits by facilitating visa issuance, launching a direct flight between Tehran and Hanoi, and setting up a joint banking committee between the two countries can also facilitate the promotion of bilateral relations.
Vietnam attaches great importance to the significant role of Iran in the West Asian region. Our country pays attention to the policy of strengthening friendship and cooperation between Iran and Vietnam in various parliamentary and governmental areas. The problem of financial exchange between the two countries can be solved by establishing a banking committee between the two countries.
Both sides have frequently supported each other in international organizations, particularly at the United Nations, to uphold multilateralism, build a multipolar world order, and respect the sovereignty and legitimate interests of nations and people. According to official reports, the volume of trade between the two nations surpassed $120 million 2 years ago, but the number has the potential to reach $2 billion in the future.
Observers believe that the visit to Tehran by Speaker of the Vietnamese Parliament after 24 years is seen as a turning point in bilateral ties, especially as it coincides with the 50th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between Iran and Vietnam. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A panel discussion dubbed systematic hate speech in violation of the right of freedom of expression by the Swedish government, with a special focus on the recent Quran desecration incidents, discussed what they refer to as government-sponsored acts of blasphemy. The participants included representatives of different monotheistic faiths as well as scholars and researchers who unanimously denounced the acts of desecration in Sweden as a violation of human rights and the right to freedom of thought, belief and religion.
The Quran burning incident in Sweden is completely unacceptable. However, we should not forget that without a government support, this would not have happened. They claim to be supporting the right of freedom of expression, but let's not forget that freedom can never be absolute. There are always boundaries, and you are free to do what you want, only if it does not undermine other people's freedom.
This was not just a desecration of the Holy Book of Muslims. In the Holy Quran, the name of God has been repeated many times. The God that we too believe in, as well as the name of our prophet Moses. Burning smoke is simply barbaric. If you disagree with an ideology or a religious belief, you should state your thoughts and your logic and discuss with the scholars. Such acts show the person who did it and those who supported his actions are incapable of doing so.
I believe that a panel discussion just like the one we had today has to be held on an international level. It is essential for people worldwide to share their opinion because such acts of blasphemy are carried out because of ignorance. Also, we have to adhere to moral values no matter what we believe in. And any person in their right mind agrees that it is against all moral standards to insult other people and their beliefs.
That is why all the participants say the recent acts of blasphemy have brought the true colors of countries that claim to be advocates of human rights to light.
Back in July, and after the Quran burning incidents in Sweden, a deeply divided UN Human Rights Council passed a controversial resolution urging countries to address, prevent, and prosecute acts of religious hatred. The resolution was passed with 20 countries voting for, 12 countries voting against, and 7 abstaining. Interestingly enough, the U.S. and the EU strongly opposed this resolution, proving once again that concepts such as human rights and freedom of expression are merely political tools at the hands of these countries. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
From Hollywood to hotel workers to Teamsters to manufacturing and elsewhere, there are so many labor actions in the United States, the mainstream media is calling it a hot labor summer. The problem isn't record heat, but low wages, poor working conditions, out-of-reach interest rates, and shocking levels of inequality amid the revocation of coronavirus-era social programs and unregulated profit hoarding by corporations. In Chicago, healthcare workers were striking for better wages and conditions amid record inflation and years of overwork.
Our members talk about all the time, does administration know how much the cost of a gallon of milk is, how much the cost of a dozen of eggs, you know, really is when you go to the store? It's just not adding up for them. They're having to pull double shifts, which is, you know, 12, 16-hour shifts in order to be able to pay their bills.
In the largest mass layoff event since 2020, 30,000 workers and their households are now out of a paycheck after shipping giant Yellow declared bankruptcy on the eve of a labor strike. The administration of Joe Biden refused Yellow a bailout of around $1 billion, although he spent $23 billion to save two banks earlier this year and sends over $1 billion per week to fuel the unrest in Ukraine. Yellow employees registered their disgust.
We was going to go out on a strike. We'd give them another 30 days to try to get their stuff together. And they forfeited. Of course, they tried trying to sue the union, which is a joke. Shame on them. They got to lay their head down on their pillow at night, what they squandered all this money away.
Corporate bankruptcies have hit their highest first half levels since 2010. And many say forcing a recession to bring down inflation is the true goal of the federal interest rate hikes, despite the damage it's already having on the average worker's household and the economy.
We understand that it's not just hospital workers, but it's a wave throughout the country in regards to a small group of people having the power and making these decisions to really not benefit the majority, but the small minority of individuals that are not having the troubles our members are paying their bills.
Widespread strikes in the United States? That's something many Americans have never seen, and certainly their mainstream media isn't spending much time talking about the labor uprisings. But the post-corona landscape is being defined by economic difficulty and social unrest. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to four counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most presidential vote polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th, and if it is time to move on from the events that day. Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system. Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate.
Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It has been 4 years since India removed the semi-autonomous status of the Indian administered portion of the Muslim-majority region of Jammu and Kashmir. But here, anger still rages. Hundreds of Pakistanis took to the streets across the country to mark this year's 5th August, the fourth anniversary of the New Delhi's decision to abolish the autonomy of the region by including it in the Indian Federation. In 2019, India scrapped the semi-autonomous status of the disputed region, a controversial move that prompted Islamabad to cut its diplomatic ties and halt trade with New Delhi. The protesters demanded the Indian government to end what they call illegal occupation of Kashmir, accusing it of grave human rights violations that are constantly being unearthed.
If this arbitrary determination is granted to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the matter will be decided once for all. And if this matter is decided, the South Asia will be peaceful. There will be no nuclear war and there will be no conflict.
People also demanded the UN to implement a decades-old resolution that called for a referendum on whether Kashmiris wanted to merge with Pakistan or India.
We want to convey our message that we Kashmiri want our basic and fundamental right that was promised by United Nations and other organizations.
Besides rallies, conferences and seminars were also held in major cities and towns to denounce human rights violations in Jammu and Kashmir.
Whoever they are at the helm of affairs, that they should come forward and they should intervene. They should try to mitigate the human rights violations.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority Himalayan region, is divided between India and Pakistan, and both claim it in full. The Kashmir dispute also led to several wars between the two nuclear-armed Asian rivals since they were separated back in 1947.
Pakistanis keep saying that they will continue to lend moral, diplomatic and political support to the just cause of Kashmir. They have also called on neighboring India to honor its commitments to the Kashmiri people regarding the right to self-determination. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A joint naval exercise meant to show Beijing and Moscow's close strategic relationship has just ended near Alaska. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. South China Morning Post has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. military's heightened response to a Russian-Chinese flotilla near Alaska was meant to send a message of force, according to a Chinese military analyst. What we see now is a flexing of muscles as the Ukraine war continues. Former People's Liberation Army instructor Song Zhongping emphasized. Song Zhongping added, "The U.S. wants to underscore that it is the real leading power in the North Atlantic by stepping up its response to the joint patrol by the Chinese and Russian navies." According to U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, four U.S. Navy destroyers, along with a P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, were sent last week to monitor the Russian and Chinese flotilla of 11 vessels. It came nearly a year after a U.S. Coast Guard ship encountered a seven-vessel Chinese-Russian fleet sailing about 75 nautical miles north of Kiska Island in the Alaskan waters. Last summer, the Chinese and Russian navies conducted a similar operation off the coast of Alaska, Senator Dan Sullivan emphasized. He continued, "Given that our response was tepid, I strongly encourage senior military leaders to be ready with a much more robust response should such another joint Chinese-Russian naval operation occur off our coast. I was heartened to see that This latest incursion was met with four U.S. Navy destroyers, which sends a strong message to President Xi Jinping and President Putin that the United States will not hesitate to protect and defend our vital national interests in Alaska, the senator said, referring to the Chinese and Russian leaders. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said the joint exercise involved communications training, helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. There was also a joint anti-submarine exercise in the southwestern part of the Bering Sea. Former People's Liberation Army instructor Song Zhongping said the joint naval exercise, which also involved a passage through the Sea of Japan, was meant to highlight the close relationship between the two countries amid the war in Ukraine. With their no-limit ties, Beijing and Moscow want to show their determination to strengthen their strategic cooperation, Song Zhongping said. Just like the U.S. freedom of navigation in the backyard of China in the Asia-Pacific, the People's Liberation Army and Russian military want to show they can sail and operate anywhere as international law allows. The Beijing-based naval expert Li Ji said the stepped-up response by the U.S. showed that Washington was concerned about the collaboration between China and Russia in the Arctic. Alaskan waters are part of the Arctic shipping routes. The joint naval drills have again reminded the United States of China's role in Russia's Arctic strategy, the naval expert Li Ji said. He added, Russia would likely see greater financial support from Beijing to finance its ambitious North Pole exploration. However, Drew Thompson, a visiting senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, said the Alaska drill might backfire on Beijing, particularly in relation to its criticism of U.S. freedom of navigation missions in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. It strikes me how difficult it is for China to continue claiming that U.S. military operations in the Western Pacific are an obstacle to improving relations when it conducts military operations off the U.S. coast on a recurring basis, Drew Thompson said. He added, it is time for China to accept U.S. military missions on its periphery and engage in military-to-military dialogue if it wants to be treated as a major world power. The Islamic Republic of Iran's Mehr news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. A large group of Russian and Chinese warships passed near the coast of Alaska last week with a group of U.S. destroyers scrambling to shadow the naval patrol, according to U.S. defense officials and lawmakers, Russia Today reported. In a statement on Saturday, two Republican senators representing the state of Alaska, Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, said a total of 11 ships had been detected transiting U.S. waters in the Aleutians, citing a classified briefing and labeling the activities an incursion. Republican Senator Dan Sullivan said he was pleased to see a robust U.S. response involving four American destroyers to the joint military exercises by China and Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Northern Command has confirmed that Russian and Chinese ships were indeed conducting a patrol in the area, but did not provide details on the number of ships involved. The agency's spokesperson also noted, according to the Wall Street Journal, that air and maritime assets under our commands conducted operations to assure the defense of the U.S. and Canada. However, the official did not confirm the senator's remarks about an incursion, stressing that the Chinese-Russian force remained in international waters and was not considered a threat. Brent Sadler, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, has called the patrol a historical first and highly provocative, considering tensions over Taiwan and the Ukraine conflict, the Wall Street Journal reported. On Friday, the Russian Defense Ministry stated that Moscow's navy was continuing its patrols in the Pacific together with Chinese warships sailing through the Sea of Japan, La Perouse Strait, the Sea of Okhotsk, and the Kamchatka Strait. It added that the drill involved a joint anti-submarine exercise as well as helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. Commenting on the military exercises, Liu Pengyu, a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington, insisted that this action is not targeted at any third party and has nothing to do with the current international and regional situation, apparently referring to the Ukraine conflict and the standoff between Washington and Beijing over Taiwan. U.S. national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. The nearly dozen Russian and Chinese ships that sailed near Alaska's Aleutian Islands last week as part of a joint naval exercise leading the U.S. to deploy warships and aircraft to monitor the formation are now moving away from the region, according to two American officials. In response to the ships' movements near the island chain, four U.S. Navy destroyers operating in the Pacific Ocean had monitored the ships' movements from various distances, one of the U.S. officials confirmed. Both officials stressed that the 11 Russian and Chinese warships remained in international waters and did not sail into U.S. territorial waters, which stretch out 12 miles from the Alaskan coastline. U.S. officials declined to provide details on how close the Russian and Chinese ships got to American territory. The patrol marked an apparent show of military unity and strength between the two countries. One of the officials told ABC News that Russian and Chinese vessels operated in different locations and were not always in the same formation. Video posted by Russia's Defense Ministry on Saturday showed what appeared to be at least 9 vessels sailing in formation and the firing of weapons into the ocean, presumably as part of what it described as an anti-submarine exercise. The Russian Defense Ministry said the joint patrol had already covered 2,300 nautical miles in a transit that had taken the Russian and Chinese Navy ships to the southwestern part of the Bering Sea, where they had practiced joint tactical maneuvering, conducted communications training, and carried out helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. A U.S. official told ABC News that the Pentagon was tracking and expecting this patrol for several weeks, since well before the exercises began. In addition to the four U.S. destroyers, a U.S. Navy P-8 maritime surveillance aircraft was also used to monitor the joint Russian-Chinese naval patrols, according to officials.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi,
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts, works, and life accounts of the most important companions of Prophet Muhammad and the Shia infallible Imam Zaymata, the host of this program. With me are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi. It's good to be here.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most important and prominent Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was martyred on their ways. He sacrificed his life for Imam Ali alayhi salam. He was among the great ulama and the great men, and the head of the tribes of the city of Kufa, Hujr ibn Adi ibn Jabalay Kendi, mainly known as Hujr ibn Adi. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you. Give us some details about the early life, the nasab, and the kunya of Hujr ibn Adi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, Hujr ibn Adi was among the companions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam first, and then he was among the companions of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wa salam. And also he was among the leaders of the Kufa people. That's why he was among the prominent or very respected kind of figures in the city of Kufa as well. So he took part in many of the battles like Jamal, like Siffin, like Nahrawan, and defended Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam against the enemies. And of course, finally he was martyred by Muawiyah while protecting and serving actually the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. And of course, about Hujr ibn Adi, the other point that we can mention here is that he belonged to a qabila or a tribe, which is called Qabila Kendi, or Kendi.
Yes, Kendi, that's right.
Yeah.
The Kendi.
We have many very well-known figures in the history of Islam from this tribe, Kendi. Of course, at the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was considered among the very great companions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He was well-known as the most pious, as the most, we can say, faithful Muslim.
Yes.
And mu'minin, even at the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in many of the futuhat and the victories of Muslims over the other areas and nations.
He was called by Prophet Muhammad Hujr al-Khair.
Yeah, of course.
That's right.
Okay. And at the time of Amir al-Mu'minin, again, he had very great role in the different, particularly in the different battles like Jamal, like Siffin and Nahrawan and all these battles.
Yes.
He had a very great role, a very significant role.
That's all right. They say it is believed that he only recounted, or supposed to say, narrated the ahadith only from Imam Ali alayhi salam and no one else, okay? That's why he's maybe among the most authentic ones who narrated hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, Sayyid Mahdi, how was his status in the eyes of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hujr ibn Adi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, so as Sheikh Rouhani very eloquently gave us a background information on Hujr ibn Adi, this esteemed companion of the Messenger of Allah as well as Imam Ali alayhi salam, as he very put well this idea that he was in the various major battles during the Khilafah of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, he had to face three major seditions or three major fitnas, discord, if you will, that were brought out by the opposition. So the Battle of Jamal, the Battle of Siffin, and the Battle of Nahrawan. In each one of these battles, you find that Hujr ibn Adi was on the side of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And that's it's important because in all three of these battles, these were very large-scale battles, and there were battles where many of the Muslims were confused for whatever reason. They weren't able to choose between or really realize, you know, what the side of truth was, what the side of batil and falsehood was. So these individuals who, for the most part, sided with Imam Ali alayhi salam, this really said something about them, right? So Battle of Jamal, for example, they didn't side with the wife of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, Lady Aisha and Talha and Zubair. And these are not small individuals in Islamic history. They are important individuals. In the Battle of Siffin, of course, to not join with the forces of Sham, the Levant of that time, and Muawiyah and Amr As. These are also, individuals. And of course, Nahrawan, which was the result of Siffin and arbitration and the Khawarij. And so in all these situations, we find that Hujr ibn Adi, he always chose Imam Ali, alayhi salam, and he was always on the side of the forces of truth. He was a commander in these battles. For example, in the Battle of Nahrawan, Imam Ali alayhi salam sent about 4,000 soldiers with Hujr ibn Adi under his command to go and fight the Khawarij. And in the other battles, you find the same, that he was a very important commander and supporter of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
That's all right. He was killed, we can say, by Muawiyah. Muawiyah ordered Mughirat ibn Shu'bah, the ruler of the Kufa, to curse Imam Ali alayhi salam on Manabir, in Masajid, unfortunately, on that time. And Hujr and Abd ibn Khuza'i were among the people who opposed this action. So the very enmity of Muawiyah to Hujr ibn Adi started from over there. Hujr complained, "Why do you curse Ali ibn Abi Talib, the best person after the demise of Prophet Muhammad on the Manabir, and do that?" This is why he was imprisoned, he was killed. So many people and so many great companions of Prophet Muhammad sent their people in order to do shafa for him or something like that. But unfortunately, they were not successful, and Muawiyah finally killed him.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
He was also with Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, isn't it, Sheikh?
Yes, of course. Regarding Hujr ibn Adi, some very nice points are here that should be mentioned. First of all, that at the time of Amir al-Mu'minin, historically talking, we have three groups of people. Some people were opposed to Amir al-Mu'minin, some people were loyal to Amir al-Mu'minin, some people were silent. Mm-hmm. This group of people were also there. They didn't take part to any sides, did not support any sides.
Okay.
So, in that kind of situation, because these people were really, really skeptical that, okay, which side is true? Because on the one side, we had Aisha, who was a very great companion, or the wife of the Holy Prophet, Talha, Zubair. They were really great personalities in the history. Now when we talk, we might think that they were not such important figures, but they were really important figures for the Muslims. And to the extent that many of the people were so much doubtful that, okay, which side is true? Either we follow Amir al-Mu'mineen or the other side. Finally, they decided to keep silent, not to support any of these sides. So now the question is that when we come to the people like Hujr was loyal to Amir al-Mu'mineen up to the end of his life. Mm-hmm. Look, we had those kind of doubts, skepticisms there, but he was still the most faithful companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, which is really, really significant because he had a very wholeheartedly iman to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, to the Ahl al-Bayt. That's really, really nice. And even at the time of Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam, he was that much loyal to Ahl al-Bayt that he even referred to Imam Hassan that, why don't you fight against them because they are batil?
Yes.
Then Imam Hassan said, okay. So Imam knew more than Hujr ibn Adi. Then he advised him that, gave him this piece of advice that, okay, now we should safeguard the life of the people, the followers of the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam.
Imam al-Hussein also invited him
to listen to Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba. And finally, he was convinced.
Yes.
But in the treaty and the agreement was signed between Muawiyah and Imam Hassan, one of the articles was this, that Muawiyah should no longer curse Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salatu wassalam. But we see that Hakim al-Kufa, the ruler of Kufa in the presence of Imam Hassan alayhi salatu was salam cursed Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Oh.
Look, this is the characteristics of Muawiyah.
Yes.
He signed the agreement that we will never curse Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wasalam. But unfortunately, in the Kufa, in the city where Imam Hassan is there, and there in that city he signed the agreement.
Yes.
The Hakim, the ruler of Kufa, cursed Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wasalam. Then Hijr and the other companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, of course, resisted and also opposed these kind of actions of the ruler of the Kufa. But the final point that I want to emphasize is Shahada. You know, when he was taken as a captive, so they were treating like slaves during those, taking them from Kufa to Damascus to Sham. But even at that time, they gave the chance to Hujr that if you curse Ali alayhi salatu wasalam there in the Sahara, in the place where no one is there.
Uh-huh.
You know, even at that time, they told him that curse Ali alayhi salatu wasalam here, no one will see you.
Mm-hmm.
It will not be recorded, you know?
Yes.
Because you and also the soldiers of Muawiyah are there.
Yes.
Even in that place, he did not curse Ali alayhi salatu wasalam.
Okay.
I said, I will never curse him. That's why they killed him there.
Oh.
In a very, you can say, desert area.
It was
area.
The same place that he was victorious in when spreading Islam over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, finally. Right. But this is nice. This okay. is nice that
yes,
even
he could do
taqiyya there.
Yes.
But he finally decided that if he sacrificed his life for Amir al-Mu'minin, even in this area where no one is there, that would be the highest level of ikhlas,
mm-hmm.
sincerity, and iman to the Ahlul Bayt. We do not have such kind of figures in history. Few people are like these people in history. That's why Hujr has a very great status in the history of Islam, particularly in the history of the Shayyu.
That's all right. Okay, Sayyid Mehdi, any other important points regarding the life of Hujr ibn Adi?
I think it's also based upon what Sheikh Rouhani kind of pointed out, which was interesting, this idea that, you know, we might think that what is the big deal about cursing Imam Ali alayhi salam or any of the Ahlul Bayt at that time? And we find that the Bani Umayyah, and this, of course this started with Muawiyah, and it continued through the Bani Umayyah, this cursing of Imam Ali alayhi salam from the pulpit. And it's something that we regularly hear, but we don't really think about, you know, what's the big deal? You go on the mimbar, on the pulpit, and you curse an individual. What impact does that have?
Okay.
But that is the propaganda machine, that is the media of that age. And so when the Bani Umayyah and Muawiyah, the whole point was that when you say this from the mimbar, it will not only decrease the value of Amir al-Mu'mineen in the eyes of the people, but the value will be decreased, their own value of the Bani Umayyah will increase, and they'll start to change, you know, who is good, who is bad, what is truth, and what is falsehood.
Yes.
And so this is the importance of cursing and doing lan on these, beautiful infallibles was a propaganda war, a media war at that time. And they played it very well, which is very interesting, to the point where, you know, as famously we hear that when Imam Ali alayhi salam was martyred, they said, what was he doing in the masjid, right?
Yes.
This is the amount of power that was being fueled via propaganda. And I just wanted to echo that point that, well, fine, you know, doing it on the pulpit is a different thing, but Hujr ibn Adi here, you know, as Agha very, very beautifully pointed out, there was nobody there that they could have used. Even though, you know, we give them the benefit of the doubt, they probably would have found a way to use that cursing
along
of Hujr ibn Adi.
There were seven other persons who did so.
Right, who did so.
He did so, and they saved their lives, but Hujr did not do that, okay?
One last thing, and again, I would like Sheikh Rouhani to also chip in on this, but this idea where when Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam, when he went for the peace treaty, in this situation there was a lot of confusion, and really the whole obedience and the ita'at and the obedience, the allegiance to an imam lies in every action of that imam.
That's right.
Right?
Okay.
And so sometimes people didn't understand what the imams did.
Mm-hmm.
themselves, right? Rationally, people didn't understand, you know, why is he going to fight? Why is he doing a peace treaty? And so there were some people who unfortunately didn't understand. But there was an interesting point here that when Hujr ibn Adi, right, he went, so he saw Imam Ali alayhi salam fight Muawiyah his whole life. And then Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, because of the conditions, right, it was better to do the peace treaty. He didn't understand why we stopped fighting when we were fighting Muawiyah for so many years. Now we're doing a same treaty, a peace treaty with the same individual. But what's interesting, sometimes, you know, they say that Imam Hussein was not in line with this peace treaty. Here, Hujr ibn Adi, he goes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and he says that we should continue fighting. We shouldn't do this peace treaty. But Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he supports the Imam of his time, right? He says, no, we should do what Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam is doing. We should follow the Imam of the time, and he is correct in what he is doing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mehdi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration. As we said, Muawiyah ordered killing Hujr, and so many criticisms come after the martyrdom of Hujr ibn Adi to Muawiyah. Even the close, we can say, friends of Muawiyah has condemned this action. Imam Hussein alayhi salam wrote a letter on that time to Muawiyah and said that it was one of the most dirtiest actions that you did, I mean, killing and martyring Hujr ibn Adi. During recent years, you know, the Salafis in Syria, we can see, exhumated the grave of Hujr ibn Adi. And unfortunately...
Can I add one point here?
Yeah, his whole grave was demolished.
You know, I want to make a comparison. I want to make a very short comparison between Imam Ali and Muawiyah. Mm-hmm. How did Imam Ali alayhi salam treat the asir who wanted to kill Ali alayhi salam?
Uh-huh.
Okay? But how did he, Muawiyah, treat an asir? Mm-hmm. Was in the hand of the army of Muawiyah.
They say killing of an asir was not allowed in Islam, yes.
You know, the killer of Imam Ali was treated very nicely, very kindly by Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Yes.
Because Imam said that you cannot do anything till I am alive.
Yes.
I will either forgive him or kill him.
Yes.
So he was asir. He would try to kill Imam Ali. This way Imam Ali treated an asir.
Yes.
But look at Muawiyah. What did he do with asir, with Usara?
Mm-hmm.
So you see, killing an asir, is it?
Yes.
That's why the very close people to Muawiyah condemned him.
Yes, that's right. Thank you very much. Again, the demolition and the exhumation of the body of Hujr ibn Adi in the recent years in Syria by the Salafis was condemned by outstanding ulama like Sayyid Ali Sistani, Ayatollah Safi Golpaygani, Jafar Sobhani and Nasser Makarem Shirazi, okay, in the recent years, unfortunately. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mehdi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Hujr ibn Adi, one of the most outstanding companions of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali alayhi salam. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you. Fi aman.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.